A very special guest to kick off the show today, David Zweig joining us, author of Invisibles. You might have read his work if you've been on the internet. It's all over the place, right? The Atlantic, New York Times, Wired, and so on and so forth. Forthcoming book, An Abundance of Caution, which I'm sure we'll get to. David, thanks for being with us this morning.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Excited to talk with you because I've been following a lot of your work over the course, especially of the last few years. And I want to start off with this because I have an idea what your answer is going to be. But where do you fall on this spectrum of people, many of whom never want to hear the word COVID again and are more than happy to move on, versus this need for accountability and to kind of recognize failures that we have as a society over the last few years?
Where am I on that spectrum? Well, I am writing a book about American schools during the pandemic, so I guess I fall on one end of that spectrum. I am sick of COVID and sick of hearing about it, on the one hand. I'm pretty burned out on the topic at this point. Yet there's something about the pandemic, or many things about the pandemic, that I find.
Oh, man. That didn't sound good. That sounded like AOL dial-up 1997, right? Before you got a reliable phone line connection and the internet just, right? It's like, and if the static never stopped, that would mean that the internet was just not going to happen for you that day. So we'll try and reconnect with David. But as you mentioned, his forthcoming book does look into this topic. And you were just saying how people are
burned out.
Sorry. You're back. People are burned out on the topic.
Yes.
But like, there is a reason why we're continuing to every now and then look back at it.
Right. So I was saying, you know, I'm not sure where I got cut off. I'm writing a book about American schools during the pandemic and what happened, this just completely unprecedented event. And as burned out as I am about the pandemic, there's something about it for me that I think will still does now and perhaps always will capture a part of my interest and imagination. I mean, probably everyone listening, this was, you know, the most, or certainly near the top, single most important event in our country in many, many years. And there's just so much there to explore. And I think the reverberations are still going to be felt in a variety of ways, even if we're not specifically talking about it.
What really compelled me to have you on was one of your latest pieces called The Most Important Test You've Never Heard Of. And it's one of these countless stories of important tools or pieces of data that just somehow kind of fell by the wayside. What was this test and what could it have told us?
Yeah, thanks. So yeah, I wrote about this on my Substack, which is where I'm doing a newsletter now, davidzweig.substack.com, for anyone interested. And this test, to me, is one of those things, as you mentioned, that the entire course of the pandemic could have been different had our government officials acted differently and made some different decisions. So this was a test that was designed at Stanford quite early in the pandemic. And I think it was ready as early as May of 2020. And this test enabled you to find out definitively whether you were contagious to other people or not. As everyone remembers, a big part of the pandemic was this idea of people who were asymptomatic, who didn't have symptoms, but who nevertheless may have been infected, wandering around and infecting people. And much of our pandemic response was based on that idea. People may remember when Anthony Fauci and the CDC reversed course. First, they said, don't bother wearing masks. And then they said, everyone needs to wear a mask. The reason given for why they changed course was because there was asymptomatic transmission. It was so important that you know, we need to all wear masks. That is why schools made kids spread 6 feet apart and had to be, the classes were, if they were open at all, were half empty. All of this was based on the idea that every person was this kind of possibly unknowing one-man WMD, that you might be infecting other people. And this test would have given people the ability to know quite quickly, one way or the other, whether they actually, not only did they have COVID, but were they infectious or not? And it was never rolled out.
It was kind of eye-opening to that this existed early on. Why did this get ignored or overlooked or just kind of left behind?
Yeah, I never got a clear answer on that. You know, and yes, this blew my mind. I've been writing about COVID and, you know, and all the details of the science and speak with infectious disease specialists, you know, all the time. And this was one of those few moments where I really stopped in my tracks when I heard about it. And I conversed with several of the authors of this study, and I talked with some other infectious disease specialists to try to get an understanding, and no one really had a good answer. And this is just one of those things where it's like the priorities or the narratives, I guess, that were being followed by the powers that be for whatever reasons just didn't make sense. And I'll tell you something where it gets worse. The CDC actually published the results of an early study showing the accuracy of this test. So it's not like they didn't know about it. You know, this is at Stanford, one of our top, academic institutions in the country. So it was absolutely remarkable that a tool existed very early in the spring to give us answers to this question that was posed that, you know, we didn't know. For me, my focus has been on schools for much of this and the science or lack thereof behind a lot of the interventions. And it is remarkable to think that kids constantly were being quarantined. Kids were forced to be separated by 6 feet. All this was based on this idea that we didn't know. We don't know who is or is not infectious, but we could have known. They could have rolled this test out, put some money behind it, had it in every, Quest or LabCorp around the country. And I don't know if we have time in our segment, but the other important part is they actually found out a very good idea about how many people or what proportion of people who were actually infected were infectious. And it was very surprising.
I mean, it's surprising. It's eye-opening is a better word. Surprising is, I'm not surprised by so much anymore. Especially when you said that, it's hard to get answers from people. It was hard to get answers from anybody, right? at any point. And you mentioned schools because, right, the past 3 years were really this strange time. You had people kind of grabbing control of everything, right? The ability to open and close schools or businesses or what you wear in public or anything like that. But no one was really willing to say what they were doing. Like, schools are the perfect example, right? Whenever you pointed the finger, you got deflected to somebody else because the state or the county could say, hey, we're just following the CDC. And the CDC will say, well, we're just recommendations. We're not actually forcing anyone to shut down or anything like that, even though they know that that's how people were taking their recommendations. You go back to the district, they say they're waiting on the CDC and so on and so forth. And it's like, you're just spinning around looking at where you get these answers from.
That's exactly right. And I've written about this a lot. And we could see this take place in a whole range, with questions, including with the one in particular were vaccine mandates for young people. The CDC used the word should rather than the word may get kids, quote, should get this vaccine. And what happened was that word was then interpreted by many places as an invitation to require it, to mandate it. And then when people questioned or complained to the universities or ever, oh, my 18-year-old son already had COVID and maybe he already has one dose. He doesn't need two or three doses. And then the universities would say, no, 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 the CDC used the word should, so that means mandate. And then the CDC said, we just give guidance. We don't mandate it. And Fauci actually similarly said this, I didn't close any schools. Well, yes, you didn't go there with a padlock and lock the door, but your guidance led to administrators, you know, and bureaucrats making these rules. So there was this circular defense of one organization or agency giving guidance that was, you know, directional toward requiring certain things. And then the people who put it into practice saying, don't look at us. We just followed the CDC, and back and forth we went.
So, you know, going back to where we started, you know, the need for recognition and accountability, how do you ever get there if everyone is kind of saying, well, I didn't really do anything these last few years. It was that guy.
Yeah, well, it's really challenging. And, you know, I guess, abstractly, that's one of the reasons why I'm working on this book, is that I'm trying to create a historical document of what actually happened. I've done a lot of reporting that's been in a lot of mainstream outlets, but uniquely has been against what someone might call the mainstream narrative. In some ways, it's almost an alternative history. And this latest story that I wrote about, you know, again, kind of fits into that, where it's this thing we were told, I'll squeeze it in here before the end of my time chatting with you. What they found was that for the majority of the pandemic, only 4% of the people who were infected actually were infectious. 4%. So remember, most people who don't have symptoms aren't infected, of course. Generally, if you don't have symptoms of something, you're fine. So only a small portion of people who walking around without symptoms actually are infected. But of those people, 96% had no ability to infect anyone else anyway. So this whole notion that there's tons of people walking around with rampant, transmission from people who were unknowingly infected does not appear to be the case based on the results of this study at Stanford. It's pretty mind-blowing.
Mind-blowing. You know what? It plays into what, like, the past few years. And, you know, in my life, we've had two kids in the last 3 years who have, you know, kind of both trying to figure out parenting and everything that's going on at the same time back in 2020. And it really made me think about risk, right, in all aspects of life. I never really did before that much, but of course, like, you start with COVID and then, you know, you're a parent, you kind of do all these things with your kid, like you're wondering, what do I do versus what do I not allow him to do? And I don't know, there's all these questions. Well, anyways, I kept noticing how, I mean, first it was COVID, now I see it all over the place, how we seem kind of like obsessed with risk. And at the same time, we seem to be absolutely terrible at assessing it. And that could go from like COVID to almost anything else.
You're exactly right. You know, we are basically humans in general, and our culture in particular, we are pretty innumerate. People are very bad at judging what things actually present a risk versus other things. I can tell you, look, more children drown each year than ever did from COVID in any given year, much more. Like double. Yet, of course, we still let our kids go swimming. Life entails risk. In order to live a flourishing life, that means doing things. Every time you step out of your house, you know, you are taking on some sort of risk, but that's what you need to do in order to lead a good life. Getting in the car. So the notion of risk of COVID, and in particular for children, was extraordinarily low, on par with or below that of what the flu presented in many of our past, you know, years in the past decade. Yet their lives were turned completely upside down. You know, and many of the kids in this country, they didn't have a nice room to sit in with an iPad or whatever. They had, you know, no internet connection. Some kids who was supposed to get recruited for college football. Guess what? You're out of luck now. Your life's destroyed. You grew up in some poor neighborhood and this was your only ticket out. Sorry, school's closed for a year. Find something else to do with your life. So, I mean, the stories are endless of what happened. And I think a lot of adults, particularly adults maybe who aren't near young children a lot or who maybe live in a more well-off community, may not really have a strong understanding of the amount of destruction that happened from these school closures and just more broadly the interventions imposed on kids. And there's absolutely zero evidence that doing any of that did one lick of good at all.
I've heard people say a lot that ignorance creates fear. And, you know, that largely you kind of hear that and you go, yeah, that sounds about right. I'm wondering if this is the case of the opposite, you know, fear creating ignorance. Does it work both ways?
Mm. Wow, that's a really interesting point I hadn't thought of and well put. Yeah, I would certainly say so. People, when they are frightened, behave in irrational ways. And what I'm focused on, my research and what I'm writing about a lot in the book, is less so the behavior and thoughts of us as regular citizens, but more so that of the people in charge. And much of the response to the pandemic by the health authorities was completely at odds with everything we know up to, you know, 2020. Everything that was learned in prior decades about how to handle public health emergencies was thrown out the window. All sorts of things, and I get into a lot of detail in this in my book, all sorts of things. We have these sort of government playbooks about how to handle a respiratory virus pandemic like influenza. We didn't follow any of that stuff. And we know what things tend to work and what things don't work and why. And I think there was a degree of panic involved in the people in charge. And, you know, one of the things I think about is that guy, Sully, who landed the plane on the Hudson River. Mm-hmm. The reason that guy did it was because he didn't panic and he followed the playbook. He went by, okay, these are the things I need to do. You got to, you know, hit these three different, you know, switches and buttons. And then he went on his instincts of, you know, whatever he has, you know, thousands of hours of flight time. He followed what, you know, made sense and what you're supposed to do and did some calculations. The people in charge during the pandemic seemed to instead just kind of wing it. And there's a lot of evidence, and I've spoken with many people within the NIH and within the CDC and others, that really the original thing here was China. And when China locked down a city that, you know, has more than 10 million people, it created this precedent that until that time was unthinkable. And then all of a sudden it became something that if you are in charge of a country's health department, you were considered, quote, not doing enough or not doing the right thing if you didn't do more. So there's this idea of the more that you do, the more interventions you do, the more virtuous you were, the more, you know, both as an individual, if you wore a mask, you're a good person. And if you didn't wear it, you were a bad person. None of the evidence was taken into account. That didn't matter. All that mattered was the symbolism of doing something. And it's natural to want to do something, to feel like you have some control, to feel like you have some agency. But as we know in medicine, you know, the famous expression, first do no harm, that a lot of times our instinct to try to do something is wrong. And many times, in many instances, it is far safer and more beneficial to not act, to not do something.
Well, David, really appreciate the time. As I said before, enjoy your work and looking forward to the new book. David Zweig.
Thanks.
Joining us, author of Invisibles and the forthcoming An Abundance of Caution.